For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up now on 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. I have to begin this introduction with something of a confession. Earlier today, I was finishing Heart of the Game by S.L. Price on the treadmill, and I was crying. That's a first for me. I mean, I guess there have been a few books that moved me to tears, not very often, and never ever when I was at Razor Sharp Health Club on the treadmill reading, but there I was. I could not help myself as I reached the powerful climax of this book. And what is especially extraordinary about that is that from page one, I knew at least in a sense where this story was leading. I knew the facts that surrounded this minor league ball player named Mike Kulba, who was killed when he was struck by a baseball in a minor league game. And his long career in the minor leagues ended instantly. This extraordinary book, Heart of the Game, tells not only the story of that moment of tragedy, but the many years that led up to it of Mike and the game of baseball, which he loved so much, and of the special rigors that are part of minor league baseball. It is also the story of the young ball player who was batting at the time and who, in a sense, killed Mike Kulba, although obviously without meaning to, and the devastation which he experienced as well. This book is about so many different things, and it is beautifully crafted by S.L. Price, a writer for Sports Illustrated, whose work I have admired for a long time. And as a matter of fact, he wrote a very powerful article for Sports Illustrated that some of you may have seen about the tragedy involved when players are, on rare occasion, struck by baseballs, either pitched or hit, and occasionally seriously injured, and once in a while, even killed. This book, again, is called Heart of the Game, Life, Death, and Mercy in Minor League America, published by HarperCollins. And C.L. Price, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could talk for a moment about the ways in which you weighed this story and the various ways in which you might approach it. Maybe even ahead of that, maybe tell us a little bit about how you first became aware of the story of Mike Kulba and how at what point this began to take shape as a book project for you.
Well, it was, you know, the accident happened on July 22nd, 2007, two years ago, in Little Rock, Arkansas, in a game between the Tulsa Drillers and the Arkansas Travelers. And I had heard about the accident when it happened, like everybody else, it had come over the wires, and most newspapers ran it as sort of a certainly a shocking but small story. And I noticed and took note. I was in the midst of another story at the time. And a couple weeks later, an editor from SI called me and asked me if I'd be interested in writing maybe a 3 or 4 page story about it. And, you know, it's the kind of story that, you know, it's like one of those things like, you know, it's a train wreck. You can't take your eyes away from it. So it's one of those, death on a ball field. Intrinsically, it's one of those man, you know, bites dog stories. You're interested in it. So I said, well, let me go down and do some reporting on it and see what there is, because there was some great reporting about it when it happened. We were coming into the story late, but nobody had spoken to Tino Sanchez, who had gone off basically to sort of to take a break from baseball. He's the man who hit the ball, 28-year-old, 11-year lifer in the minor leagues. He had hit the ball that had killed Mike Kulbaugh and went back to his home in Yauco, Puerto Rico, to sort of recover himself. And I went back and joined. Tino came back to join the team in Frisco, Texas, and I went down to see him there, and I was told that he might possibly talk to me there. And when I went to that game, it also happened to be the first. It happened to be against the Frisco team, which was also a Texas League team, in which Scott Kulbaugh, Mike's brother, was also a hitting coach and a first base coach. But Tino didn't realize that at the time, when he knew he was coming back. And I was there for batting practice, and Tino was, you know, flinching when there were foul balls hit. He still was having problems recovering, but he was sort of mentally putting himself back together. And then in the first inning, he sees a man named Kulbaugh. He's sitting in the dugout, and he looks up, and he sees a man named Kulbaugh setting up in the first base box. And
he sees the name on the back of his uniform.
On the back of the jersey, and he you know, he's kind of just stunned by this, and he realizes that, you know, he's told it's Mike's brother. And then in the sort of cool, cruel way that baseball has, he's sent out to play, to sub in at first base in the eighth inning. And I had spoken to Scott previously that day, earlier that day, and I knew that Tino and Scott had not yet spoken. And I was sitting in the press box, and, you know, literally the hair on the back of my arms and neck were going up, because I'm realizing that they haven't spoken, and nobody's really paying attention. I mean, it's not like in the press box, people are saying, "My gosh, look at this!" And you know, if this were happening on the major league level, you'd have camera crews and everything else sort of recording this moment, and nobody really seemed to be taking it in.
It was an amazing sight that no one realized, or a very select few people realized.
Yeah, very, very select few people. Certainly on the benches, they realized. But I'm just saying, I was looking down at the crowd. In the press box, guys were doing their jobs. You know, this was going to be a one-paragraph story in the paper about a game between Frisco and Tulsa, and people are eating popcorn. You know, I mean, it was such an emotionally charged moment. I hadn't seen anything like that in my entire career. Such an emotionally charged moment. Tino, I knew certainly in retrospect, but even at the time, I knew that they hadn't spoken, and he was really shaken by this, and he wanted to be, you know, to say something to Scott, and I knew Scott wanted to say something to Tino, but the code of the game wouldn't allow them to speak. You don't interrupt the competition. It's just not done. And so there's this astonishing tension in the air, and, you know, people were eating their popcorn and peanuts, and the game was just going on. And right then I knew this is more than a 3 or 4 page story. I know this is a long story, but let me just finish. Then at the end of the game, I'm walking toward the clubhouse, and I see two women. The lights of the stadium are going out. The stands are empty, and Tino's standing there talking near the on deck circle, speaking with two women who I later found out were Mike's sister and Mike's sister-in-law, who had come to basically push through their pain. It was really difficult for them to see Tino. They did not blame him at all, but they came bearing a message from Mike's mom. "Listen, Tino, we don't blame you. Please understand, we'd want you to keep playing. Mike would want you to keep playing, and the family is here for you." And I just knew very quickly, you know, after seeing that scene and then speaking to Tino later that weekend, and I later found that he hadn't really spoken to anybody about it before I sat down with him, including his family. I just knew this story was bristling with so much detail that even a 9-page story in Sports Illustrated wouldn't really be able to bear all that weight. And it was one of these things that there were so many coincidences involved that led to this moment between these two. Tino himself had wanted the job that Mike Coolbaugh got 3 weeks previously. Tino was serving as the de facto hitting coach, but instead of resenting that Mike got this job, he swallowed any kind of resentment and gave Mike the shorthand, you know, sort of thumbnail sketches on the players and their tendencies and how to get to them and how to work with them and how to be a hitting coach and just trying to get him up to speed. And you know, Mike was so grateful that he'd been pushing Tino for weeks hey, let me take you out to lunch. And finally, the day before the accident, Mike and Tino went out to lunch, and they were talking baseball and war stories. Mike was a 17-year veteran of the minor leagues, and Tino was an 11-year veteran, and they had plenty to talk about. And then all of a sudden, it became clear. Tino told Mike that his wife was having their first baby. Mike's wife was also pregnant with their third baby. Both turned out to be daughters. And Tino said, the instant the subject came up, Mike's face completely changed, and he just started telling Tino how much he was going to love this and how much it was going to change his life. And Tino said that's when I understood how much he loved his family. And so it just went on and on from there. It's the first time a story. I had 50,000 words of notes by the time I was done with the story for Sports Illustrated, and I just knew that it was a story that deserved a book-length treatment.
Hmm. One of the things that had to be tough, of course, is to approach those who had been touched most directly by this tragedy. I mean, his widow, for one, his brother, for another, his parents, others in the family, as well as teammates and others who felt this sorrow so deeply. You pose an intriguing question in your acknowledgments as you begin to thank all who cooperated in the writing of this book. You said, I don't know if telling a stranger thoughts, memories, and emotions about a departed loved one, enduring a stream of clarifying emails and phone calls, can be cathartic. I don't know if repeated conversations with a stranger can somehow ease guilt or despair. After all these conversations, do you have at least a guess that is part of this experience when people share like that?
Well, I will tell you this. When I spoke to Tino for the first time that weekend, what I later found out, because then I later visited him in Yauco, Puerto Rico, but what I later found out is that when he went home after the accident, after hitting Mike with that foul ball, he didn't speak. Really, he didn't talk to anybody in his family. He didn't talk to his parents about it. He didn't talk to his wife about it. He didn't talk to friends about it. He did have some counseling with a priest in with Tulsa. But once he went home, you know, it's strange. It's the way of families, I think, in some ways. It's like they know him so well. It's like, well, we should just leave Tino alone and let him. We don't want to bother him. We don't want to raise this difficult subject with him, when exactly perhaps the opposite would have helped him. So what was strange was when I sat down with him, and I did not understand this, and it was just, I didn't know this at the time, but we spoke for 2 hours basically about everything, about that moment that had transpired, everything that had led to it. And at the end of it, because I was asking very basic questions, he was forced to sort of walk through the accident again. At the end of it, Tino thanked me, and it kind of shocked me. I'm like, thank me, thank you for being so forthcoming in this, but it was a relief for him. So there's no question that speaking about this in some ways helped him. Of course, at the same time, you know, I can't tell you how many emotional conversations I had that ended in tears. I mean, it's painful, but in some sense, I think working through that pain is helpful. I will tell you that, I mean, the Coolbaugh family were incredible. Everybody was, from start to finish. And when I first spoke to them in dealing for the article itself, I mean, Mandy, Mike's wife, told me, Well, you know, Mike was always, especially near the end of his career, his playing career ended the previous fall. You know, he kept saying, you know, I just wish that I would get some respect for what I put into this game. And you know, I think they really understood or hoped that in speaking to me that in some way Mike's career would get the respect it deserved. I mean, he was a great player by every standard except for the major league one, and a great clubhouse presence. And within the game, people understood that about him. And I think that the family, you know, wanted somebody to tell his tale, and just in the telling, imbue with Mike's career with the respect that they felt it deserved. And I will say, after having reported it, I feel it deserves. I mean, the minor leagues, as Clint Hurdle, former manager of the Rockies, told me, I mean, that's the roots of everything that we see on a major league level. It's all taught and uncoiled and woven into the souls of these guys and hammered into the souls of these guys day in and day out. The way you walk, the way you talk, the unspoken rules, not just the rules of the game that we all know, but the unspoken way of being. And Mike was an exemplar of minor league baseball, and Tino was a great example of how minor league baseball can change someone. He really accepted that code of baseball, a large part of which is taking responsibility, and it's on me. No matter, you know, no matter what happens in the game or how you feel, perhaps the politics of the game gets you, you're supposed to just say it's on me. It's my responsibility. I'm just going to work harder. And Tino really took that to heart, and to tell you the truth, I think part of that is why he took so much blame for this accident. Even though intellectually he knows he did nothing wrong, he just feels horrible even to this day about it, it's going to be a problem with him for him going forward, no question about it.
I want to ask you about one other sort of overview matter, and then we'll talk a little more specifically about Mike Kulbaugh and his career in the minor leagues and what you learned about sort of the peculiar game of minor league baseball. I want to read something from the very beginning of the book, which I find quite intriguing. At this point in time, you have just kind of laid out the sort of the spare facts of what occurred on that July evening, July 22nd, 2007, at this ballpark where Mike Kulbaugh has been struck by a baseball hit by someone on his own team. You say, there is but one blessing. Somehow the moment itself has slipped past the clutch of modern experience. No television cameras captured the ball hitting the coach. No team cameras focused on Kulbaugh as he was struck or falling. Despite the prevalence of cell phone photography and portable recorders and the internet's appetite for every recordable event, no Zapruder will surface with footage of the blow. It's as if, in that sudden erasure of noise just after, a kind hand conspired to wipe away any cheapening visuals, any reductive evidence of so public an accident, extending even to the game's official record. I am so intrigued by that. I mean, and it's true, though. I mean, we think of something like this happening, and it is with some amazement that we realize that there is essentially nothing that exists that tangibly records the moment for us, the way so many other unfortunate accidents and mishaps are recorded for us sometimes by many different people.
Right.
Tell us why you think that is worthwhile to acknowledge. I mean, what you really are grateful for there.
Well, I will tell you, it's two-track. I mean, as a reporter and as someone who's trying to understand this event and what happened and trying to bring it home to people, I will tell you that I wish there were a film that I could have seen of just so I could see what people in the ballpark saw that night. But as a human being, I'm really glad that it's not out there on the internet for anybody to click on for YouTube to see this. I mean, this is a profound moment. You know, this is a profound moment in a lot of people's lives. It's a profound moment in baseball, in the history of the game. It's a profound moment for all the ballplayers who knew that they could have been Mike Coolball, because the accidents like this are far more common than the casual fan or even the serious fan actually, I think, understands. But I just think that I don't want to see that as a human being, and I think the weight of it and the heaviness of what happened deserves a bit of mystery, because it is a mystery as to why it happened. I mean, literally, as the coroner in Little Rock told me, half a hair in either direction and Mike would still be alive, and you and I wouldn't be speaking here today. I mean, it was that close, and there's something mysterious about this event, and I feel that it deserves that mystery. And I'm as a human being, I'm glad I didn't see it. As a reporter, I wish I could have, and as a human being, I'm glad I didn't.
That really underscores the fact that as you explored this, and surely as you came to know Mike Coolball's family and others involved so directly in the story, especially Tino Sanchez, that you indeed were playing a couple of different roles simultaneously.
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange thing. I mean, I had to look. This story was the oddest one I've ever worked on, and the coincidences we can talk about in a bit. But I mean, the fact is it's a dark tale in many ways. It doesn't end well, and yet throughout the reporting of it, even in the midst of very emotional interviews, I kept finding myself saying, "Well, if it's such a dark tale, why do I feel so good?" And I have to say, I mean, I just kept, first of all, I was meeting with one quality person after high quality person after another who really felt this event deeply and in the right way, and I couldn't help but respect that and admire it, from the family, from Tino to the trainer Austin O'Shea. I mean just one person after another was so impressive to me, and then the way that they handled this event. I mean, Tino could have been a callow, you know, second-year guy who maybe paid lip service to feeling bad for Mike, but could have said, "Well, I didn't do anything wrong." But in the depth of his feeling, I think he helped the Coolball family because he understood how important Mike was, and he had lived a lot of what Mike had lived, and at the same time, the Coolball family turned to and pushed through their pain to let, and still do to this day, I mean, try and keep contact with Tino and let him understand that they don't blame him, and Scott and the whole family reached out to him to let him understand that they were there for him to call and email, and have called and emailed him. And then meanwhile, the Colorado Rockies, I mean, ballplayers are notoriously stingy, and Mike was only with the organization for 3 weeks, and the history of the game is filled with stories about guys who join a team roster midway through the season and actually help them get to a World Series and only get half a share of World Series share. But the Rockies voted Mike's family a full playoff share, came to over $230,000, and again, part of this goes to that mystery. They wouldn't talk about it. The national media sort of descended upon the Rockies as they went to the World Series and wanted to tell a feel-good story about baseball in the midst of Barry Bonds and steroids revelations, and they wouldn't have anything to do with it. They wouldn't talk about why they came to that decision or who came up with the idea. It was just too important. And then meanwhile, throughout the Texas League, you know, people reached into their pockets with ones and fives and came up with a pool of money for the Coolball family as well. So as a reporter, I had to, you know, I had to certainly sift through this, and this is, you know, I had to find out what kind of guy Mike was on my own. But as a human being, at the same time, I found myself gratified to be in this world and to be dealing with these people who really, you know, there was nowhere to hide with this story. There was nowhere to go. They all had to be who they were because the pain was so deep and the loss was so profound.
Yeah. You know, as you just said that, it occurs to me that one really awful possibility might have been that as you wrote this book and explored more deeply who Mike Coolball was, it's entirely possible you might not have liked what you found. I mean, there are a lot of people where you dig beneath what might be a very pleasant facade, and you find all kinds of dark, twisted stories. Somebody not nearly as good a person as he maybe pretended to be or projected himself to be. Of course, with Mike Kulba, that absolutely turned out not to be the case. I mean, everything you learned about him just makes us love him all the more and admire him all the more. But I should think that that's a risk one takes when you begin looking this closely at a human being's life.
Sure, and I will tell you that, well, there are two things at work. I mean, for example, I mean, Tino, and he was, you know, generous enough to do this, you know, revealed that he tested positive for amphetamines while being a minor leaguer. And part of his resolve in coming back to rejoining the Drillers, even after, I mean, he was going to retire at the end of this year. There was no reason for him to come back and join the team in their final playoff push after Mike had died, and he could have gone back to Yauco and stayed there. But one reason he came back was because he had tested positive, and yet the Rockies organization had given him chance after chance. So, you know, he was not a great guy when he first came into the game, and there were some, you know, had some negatives as a player. But I will tell you this: I was helped along by one thing as I began to go into this story, which is that if you're a lifer in the minor leagues, and this I knew instinctively, but people told me over and over again. I mean, in some ways, at least in the team construct, you're a great guy if you're a lifer, because they're not going to keep you around if you're a Bush League talent and a jerk at the same time. If you're selfish, if you're not helping out the younger guys, if you're not generous minded in the sense of helping out other people who you know are going to pass you, it takes a certain frame of mind to sort of accept that about yourself and then be generous about it at the same time. Accept your limitations and understand that you're not going to perhaps rise as high as you once thought you were, and yet you're going to help out the other guys who are going to rise past you. And Mike was that kind of guy, and Tino was that kind of guy, and their teammates really loved being around them. And so that kind of shorthand helped me, because I certainly sensed that you know, these were positive clubhouse presences under the worst kind of pressure. I mean, the thing to remember about minor league baseball players is that at one point in time, they all were superstars. They were, you know, on one level, you know, in high school or somewhere, they were the biggest thing they going in that small world. And the tough thing about minor league baseball is that eventually most of the people who go through it are suddenly slapped in the face and told, well, you know what, you're not all that great. And it's a tough realization to come to.
Yeah. We're speaking with S.L. Price. We're talking about his book, Heart of the Game, Life, Death, and Mercy in Minor League America. Actually, one of the things that haunts me most from your book and in all that you say about the life of minor league ballplayers is this particular picture. This is from the chapter called Circling. You say, "I got screwed" is one of the game's mantras, as common, if not as public, a baseball trope as boy plays catch with dad. It starts innocently enough. A kid starts his career, maybe sporting a hefty bonus, but usually not, and he's the best athlete his town ever saw. But now he's in this machine, this system, and it's large and both intensely personal and impersonal. Men walking around naked, their daily work published for all the world to see, and suddenly he feels like one of 1,000 crabs in a bucket, trying to claw his way up and out. Those words just absolutely took my breath away. And I think it's important for us to talk a bit about the rigors of this particular kind of ball and the kind of gauntlet that we are talking about. What are some of the things that you learned about minor league baseball as you learned more about this story?
Well, I you know, it's first of all, it's tough, it's cruel, it's capricious, it's arbitrary, and it's political. You know, it's Chris Burke, one of Mike's teammates and a you know, future major leaguer, told me, you know, when someone he said basically the quote was, you know, when someone says they have a love for baseball, when a baseball person says that about a baseball guy, he doesn't mean it's in some sort of Field of Dreams cinematic way. Oh, I just love baseball. He said it's a love-hate relationship with the game, and you know, you want to beat the game because it's so tough on you. And it's a much more complicated picture. I mean, Scott Kobal, Mike's brother, said basically, I got screwed is a everybody has a war story. That's what he calls them. I mean, everybody has a story about how you know, somebody with a bigger signing bonus was given all the breaks, even though they were being outplayed by somebody with a smaller signing bonus. And that basically you can be constantly angry if you let yourself about all the breaks that have gone against you. And the only solace that these guys find, especially the ones who've been there for a while, is when they get out those three and a half hours out on the field. And as Scott said, you suddenly say, "Oh, so this is why I'm doing this." And then he said, "But once the game is over, you go back to being pissed off again." It's a very, very tough existence. You almost should look at any major league player you see as the tip of the iceberg, and beneath the surface there are literally, you know, hundreds and thousands of guys who that person passed. And sometimes rightly. I'm not saying that Mike was a major league player who got, you know, major league talent who would have been a superstar on any on a major league level. Most people don't believe that. But these guys, there's a lot of heartbreak left behind, and it's a brutal existence.
You say at one point, minor league baseball is an endless winnowing process, cast for months into a confined space where people are promoted, demoted, traded, and released every day, where today's teammate is tomorrow's memory. It is impossible to relax. A little later in that chapter, you say this. I'm so intrigued by this, and this is actually Tino Sanchez talking, I think, and you say, you go hitless three games, you want to kill yourself. You think your career is over. And after a win, a 3-for-4 day, a 2-hit outing, the place feels like a wedding. Smiles, straight backs, brave talk about the future. To be whipsawed between the two is a daily ordeal, corrosive to the soul and all too public. Those last words are yours. And I think that's an intriguing part of all of this, too, that it's the ups and downs, which maybe aren't corrosive in other arenas of our life, when it comes to something like this where the stakes are so high, really take a toll all their own.
Absolutely. And then, you know, you throw in the sort of cliches of minor league baseball that are cliches because they're true. I mean, there are 12-hour bus rides. You know, the food is not very good. The lodgings are substandard in some places. That's all true, especially at the lower levels of the game. And so, you know, it's an exhausting existence, and it's unforgiving in many ways. And at the same time, you're constantly questioning yourself, and you're being told to question yourself because the essence of baseball, in many ways, is failure. I mean, the cliche, of course, is you fail 7 out of 10 times at the plate, and you're a star. And so you're basically, and these guys are not doing that. You know, they're sitting still or watching someone pass them. And I tell you, it's a strange thing because I only have even a greater respect having sort of immersed myself in this world as much as I could for this book, for the sort of pitiless trek these guys are on, because it's really, really tough.
One of the things that makes it especially hard is that there is the sense that it does not always come down to how wonderfully you yourself are playing, that it is about more than that, and sometimes about more than that in ways that for a given player can be tremendously unfair. One of the realities involves if someone has been signed with a large bonus, and that makes a difference in terms of, in a sense, how important it is for a given club that that particular player becomes successful. Explain how that could play out very badly for a more middle-of-the-road talent like Mike Kulba.
Well, it's it played out exactly that way for Mike. I mean, he was scouted by one of the great legends in the game, Al LaMacchia, a 50-year scout in baseball, whose latest find is Andre Ethier, who's starring right now for the Los Angeles Dodgers. Well, Al LaMacchia was convinced that Mike, and is still convinced to this day. He said, "I'll hold up my hand and say I was wrong about anybody, but Mike Kulba just didn't get the chance that he deserved." And what Al LaMacchia would call Mike was a leper. He said, "Basically, Mike, you're a leper, and that's why you're not getting the chance." And Mike's like, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, you know, you basically didn't get enough money on your signing, but Mike was signed for like $80,000, and he was a low draft choice. And meanwhile, Chris Wenke, who went on to win the Heisman Trophy with Florida State, the oldest Heisman Trophy winner ever, after his baseball career went south, was signed, and he was for over $300,000, and Wenke was not as certainly was a failure on almost every level with the Toronto Blue Jays organization, but he was ahead of Mike. He was drafted in the same draft, and basically every time he messed up, because by virtue of his bonus, the fact is that the entire organization literally was invested in Chris Wenke to try and make sure that he had every chance to succeed and to minimize his failures, because they had put all that money into him. They had placed a bet on him. And so Mike was constantly, even though he was improving at a far faster rate and eventually was a better player than Chris Wenke by far, he just was not going to get the chances that Chris Wenke did, and eventually he was sort of flushed out of the organization. And Al LaMacchia to this day, I mean, you know, one of the ironies of this, Mike died on Al LaMacchia's birthday, and it was one of the, he mourns that to this day, Al LaMacchia does. I mean, they're not close. They weren't close. A scout doesn't have that kind of relationship with the people he brings up, but Mike provided a special kind of heartbreak for Al LaMacchia, because he really feels that he and Al would have screaming matches with he was a vice president at the time with the Blue Jays organization about, you know, just give this kid a chance, but he was fighting a losing battle, and that really hurt Mike.
You quote somebody else, and I don't know his first name now. The last name is Papura, something like
Tim
that.
Tim Papura. Yep.
Also talking about Mike and trying to explain why he never quite cracked through to the major leagues. He says at one point, he was good enough, yes, but always in organizations where someone was a bit better. But that didn't mean that the baseball men didn't know they could have been wrong, in the sense that they could be wrong about anyone. The mystery of talent reacting to the ultimate pressure and the best competition remains as deep as ever. The opportunities just never came for him at the right time, in the right circumstance. Honestly, he had talent. There just wasn't the opening. I'm so struck by that idea of the opportunities not being there at the right time. I mean, and for other people, of course, everything just falls into place so beautifully. And unfortunately, it was not to be for Mike Kulba. It's not all that often that we hear these kind of stories, because we don't write stories about the people who don't quite make it.
Right, the ones who just missed. We don't write about Mr. Just Missed. We write about the guy who broke through. And the fact is Mike was hard luck. I mean, he was in the Houston organization, but he was constantly behind Morgan Ensberg at third base. So he was not going to move up to the major leagues. It just wasn't going to happen. And then, for example, in 2005, he puts together a great year where it looks like he's going to be called up, and just when he's, you know, getting ready for the September call up, his hand is broken. You know, and that happened. And then the following spring training, he went to Kansas City, a place where he could expect to possibly move up, because they're certainly not as talent-rich as other organizations. And first day of spring training, he takes a ball on the wrist and breaks his wrist. I mean, it just was constant for Mike that way. The deck was stacked against him for any number of reasons, and it's just tough, but he kept pushing on.
You write at one point, it's enough to make a cynic out of any saint.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the great miracles of Mike Kulba is that he retained his love of this game to such a great extent. I know our time is almost gone. I want to ask you two things, and I'll let you choose whatever time you have to answer these questions. I want, first of all, I know that you have made mention of some of the amazing coincidences that are part of this game, the story of Mike Coolbaugh and this tragedy which ultimately befell him. And I would invite you to share a couple of the most intriguing. And I would like us to finish by you sharing the story of none of this unhappiness involving his frustrations or his final tragedy, but the moment of splendor which he experienced right up for the road from us in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, with his first major league home run.
Sure. Well, I mean, the thing is, on that night, July 22nd, 2007, the ballpark, I mean, one of the things that struck me about the story is how many people were in the ballpark that night who had sort of personal experience with the damage a ball could do. Bill Valentine, who was behind the plate 40 years previously when Tony Conigliaro, as an umpire, when Tony Conigliaro, the Boston Red Sox outfielder, was notoriously beamed in the face, had a just his face, his eye just sort of grew to the size of a grapefruit. Bill Valentine was behind the plate for Conigliaro, and he was the Arkansas Travelers basically general manager, and happened to be in the radio booth that night for the first time in years, serving as sort of a, you know, sudden color man. And he said he's never seen a ball hit harder than the one that Tino Sanchez laced foul that night. Bo McLaughlin, the pitching coach for the Tulsa Drillers, had his career ended by a Harold Baines comebacker up the middle that shattered his face. John Asahina, a Tulsa Drillers pitcher on that same field in Arkansas a few 3 months previously, earlier in the season, had his skull fractured by a comebacker, and his first time on the field, on a playing field during a game, was that game when he was called out to get the medical kit. And then the gentleman who Warren Stevens, a billionaire financier in Little Rock, who basically donated the land for the new brand new Dickie Stevens ballpark that year. It had just opened. He was there for opening night, and suddenly, just the night of that game, he just decided on a whim to go out to the ballpark for the first time since opening night. And his father had his career ended by a ball to the head. So that was, you know, just that alone was striking to me. And then meanwhile, Mike, who was not given to sort of dark, macabre thoughts in any way, morbidity, the entire spring was, you know, his career had ended, and certainly, you know, that's a time to take stock. But he was telling his wife Mandy, you know, we've got to set up our funeral plots together, and I want to teach you and make sure you understand how I do finances in case something happens to me. And then, you know, most sort of strikingly for me, you know, Mike would take his two sons, Joey and Jake, out to, you know, they were 5 and 3 years old, and teach them how to hit in the front yard and work with their batting stance and everything else. And Mandy would usually take that time to take a rest and take a break from the kids. And Mike that spring would constantly say, no, I want you to come out and sit here because I want you to be able to teach the boys how to hit in case something ever happens to me. And so, you know, that sort of recurrence over and over of that kind of thing is just so striking to me. And you know, just a few months before, Mike had one final chance to perhaps play professionally with a Mexican team, and he thought about it, and he went out with a friend of his best friend, Jay Maldonado, in San Antonio, and Jay was a former pitcher, minor league pitcher, and Mike blasted a ball at the middle and laid Jay out with a ball to the head, and they, you know, thought he died, and it's just one thing after another. I found it really striking, the coincidences here. But you know, again, as you say, I mean, you know, it's not all dark. I mean, Mike did have that great movie moment, and that was you know, in 2001, Mike was finally called up after, you know, 12 years, in his 12th season in the minors, called up suddenly by the Brewers, and in Miller Park he had his day suddenly. He got his first at bat. He had a nice base hit to left, and his parents had been out of touch They were on vacation out of cell phone communication, and Mandy had been in Chicago. And when they heard Mike had been called up, they just went crazy. And just and his parents drove all night from upstate New York to get to Milwaukee, and they made it to Mike's second game that he played. And Mandy was there as well, and his sister, and the whole family came. And it was really just a wonderful thing because the whole family, of course, all minor league families invest so much of their time and energy and money into you know, supporting these guys. And Mike was able to drive a John Garland pitch over the fence for a home run. And you know, he had said before the game, you know, "Mom, I'm going to have a great game today. My dad is here." And his dad was, you know, one of those hard-driving fathers, but his dad was so sort of taken with the beauty of the swing. He went out and watched it on the concourse TVs and the replays, and he said it's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And Mike, you know, Mike had that cup of coffee. I mean, he played the next year. He had 44 at bats, I think, with total, and he played a bit with Milwaukee and then a bit with St. Louis the next year. Even shorter cup of coffee there. His biggest problem or his biggest complaint was, or hope was, he just wanted a – baseball is a game of succeeding over time. You can't prove anything over 5 games or 10 games or even, you know, coming in over, you know, in spotty situations, you know, every once in a while. I mean, it's about success over 162 games. And Mike just wanted the chance to understand whether he was a success or a failure. And the only way to know that in baseball terms is if you have a chance to succeed or fail – over a real stretch of time, and that's the heartbreak for him. He got his whiff of major league ball, and he showed he could hit that home run, and I can't tell you it's remembered with great fondness throughout the family. And Mike loved that moment like you wouldn't believe. But he the break he didn't get was the ability to show whether he could succeed or fail on a big league level, you know, over time, and it stayed with him.
Hmm. Well, of course, he was a great success in many other ways, especially as a husband and as a tremendously devoted father and friend. And one of the tributes to that is 700 people coming to his funeral, including the umpiring crew from that game where he was killed, driving 633 miles through the night in order to pay their respects, as did many others, to this good man. Are you in touch with the principals even now after the book has been published? And do you know much about how this book is received by them?
Yeah, no, I went on a book tour, and I went to San Antonio, and many Mandy and the kids came, and they as well as some members of the extended Coolball family, and I've gotten emails, and they seem happy with the book. I mean, I think. You know, I mean, it's a tough thing. I said to them, look, please don't feel like you have to read it or come, because I didn't want them to go through any more pain. But it is what it is, as they say in baseball terms. I mean, they came and they were incredibly supportive. And then I went to a Tulsa Drillers game, and the trainer who I have great regard for the Tulsa team, and the umpire who's behind that plate came up that night and just happened to be there that same game. And people, I think, understand. I mean, I wanted to give this man and this life, meaning the minor league life, the greatest respect I could while showing exactly what it was about. And they seem to be happy about it. Tino, meanwhile, I've spoken to him this past spring, and I've spoken to his dad, and I know that over Christmas time, Tino was still having a hard time. Holidays are hard for him too, because it hits him that, you know, Mike's kids are growing up without a father, and I know he was having a rough time this past holiday season. It's going to be a tough road for him, and I think he's a superb man, and I'm sure if he wants to get back in baseball as a coach, he can, but it's going to be a mixed bag for him, because it's what he knows, it's what he loves, but in some ways I think it hurts him now to be on the field.
Sure, he can't possibly love it in the innocent way that he once did.
Yeah.
The book is Heart of the Game, Life, Death, and Mercy in Minor League America. It's published by Echo, which is a division of HarperCollins. S.L. Price, I thank you so much for writing this really, really marvelous book. I do appreciate the chance to speak with you about it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our weather forecast is for sunny skies today. We're headed for a high of 79. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.